Hello, and welcome to Chatter, a podcast from The Gist. On today's show, we're talking to Kelly Armstrong of the Alliance Party. We spoke to her about TransLink, about the transport infrastructure in Northern Ireland, about the health service, and about the absolute mess going on at Stormont at the minute. If you enjoy the show, you can share us on Facebook, Twitter, all across social media, and you now find us on iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. So be sure to subscribe if you want to hear more. So here's the interview. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
To start with transport, I just sort of want to get a grasp on where you stand on privatisation versus nationalisation in terms of what's the best way to deal with transport in general. Like, do you have a personal opinion on whether one is better than the other?
Before I became an MLA, I worked in community transport. I was the director for Northern Ireland of the Community Transport Association. And thanks to that role, I had a lot of experience of transport strategy and policy within Northern Ireland, but then also transport strategy and policy across the whole of the United Kingdom and beyond into Europe. In Northern Ireland, we have a restricted transport network wherein TransLink are the main public transport provider, although they're a public corporation, so it's not a true nationalised transport. It was in the past, it's been developed, but I have to say that would be my preferred model, because having worked with local authorities across England, where they don't have a regulated system there, it's deregulated, and they have a lot of private operators. When they put out contracts for different types of transport routes, the cherry picking happens, and you get public transport is taken, the main routes, the profitable routes are taken by those companies who can be bothered with it, and then you're left with social isolation, because there are a lot of pockets of rural areas, particularly deprived areas where there's a lot of people who are living in poverty, who they just don't want to go into. They won't touch with a 10-foot barge pole. And in my previous existence, I worked with a lot of community organisations who had to then set up car sharing schemes using volunteers, minibuses, to try and meet the demand of those people who don't drive, who have limited mobility, who are unable to get about, who needed public transport, but because their local authority couldn't get a private transport operator to deliver services in that area, there was no other option for them. And I find that the system that we have here in Northern Ireland, while it's not perfect, it's a heck of a lot better when it comes to rural dwellers. Mm. Now, I'm a rural dweller. I live in the back end of beyond, down the Ards Peninsula. For me to use public transport to be able to even get to Stormont would be quite difficult, because I would have to drive a certain period of time before I get to a main road where I could park, be able to get a public transport if the public transport bus is going to take me where I need to go. But in many of the areas of local authorities that I dealt with in England, Scotland and Wales, there wasn't even that option, because when they got to the main road, the public transport provider, albeit a private operator, wasn't there. You know, there was no service. So our system's flawed, but it's a catch-22. We have a catch-22 in Northern Ireland. We need more people to use the service. And if we do that, then you'll have a better service and a more regular service, but you need to get people to do that modal shift first. Okay. It's a difficult one, but I'm more in the vein of how we have done it at the moment. I think that the public corporation model that TransLink has, public transport is never going to be fully sustainable. Mm. There's no way in this good earth you're ever going to have a public transport system that will completely fund itself. Mm. So what we've done with TransLink, which I think is the right thing to do, is to enable them to be set up as a company that can be income generating, and they can also have availability to investment resources that they can go looking for outside of government that reduces the burden on the public purse. But I still believe that it's a public service that they're providing. So in areas where it's not profitable, and during the day, for instance, when there aren't as many people travelling, we do need to have public transport services. And that's why I believe that it should be kept within the public realm, or within the public ownership. Now we do have NIFCO, who's the overarching body that owns it, that government still have. There's no share. Like, for instance, their shares are generated through TransLink, but nobody gets any money from it. The shareholder is NIFCO, which is the Northern Ireland government.
Okay.
So the money goes back into the company again. It's not as if you have fat cats sitting just taking a wage out of this. Yeah. So Chris Conway,
it's not profitable enough for that.
Well, they actually do make money.
I know they ran a profit last year, but I mean, it's not to the point where they can take outrageous bonuses, because it is just sort of getting there in terms of profit. Like, it is like a little bit profitable, but not to the extent that you would have in
I would be expecting them as a sustainable business to have that profit, because they need, if they want to replace vehicles in the future, especially if we're walking away from European money opportunities, you know, we need to our public transport organisation to be able to generate a small surplus so that that could be reinvested into capital for vehicles or for, you know, different, putting money into those routes in, say, in the West that wouldn't be as profitable as somewhere up near Belfast, you know, because there's less bodies on the bus. So I would be expecting that, but it's how they use their money. Now, I know that Department of Infrastructure have forced TransLink to really expend quite a lot of their reserves. They will get into difficulty soon with that, because you do have to have an amount of reserves to be a feasible company. And we're getting close to the edge on that one, so there's more investment is needed. And I have, for the last 15, 16 years, been fighting constantly with the Department of Infrastructure as DRD to rebalance road infrastructure investment with public transport infrastructure investment. And if they want to be realistic about it, they need to rebalance that. I think it had been 80-20. I think it's 70% of our money's and infrastructure spent on roads. Come on, we need to put more. We're spending far, far less on our public transport than other countries in the UK do.
I couldn't agree more when it comes to the spending. Something you mentioned there actually was about the day transport and the sort of lack of profitable routes and the sort of fragmentation that can happen in terms of, like, private companies pushing towards the most profitable routes. I'm gonna go really specific here, in terms of, like, where I live and I've had to deal with in terms of getting into Belfast for public, using public transport, in that now the route that I use personally is an Ulster bus route. So it's from Cumber, and it goes in to town, and it now they've reduced the routes so much that, like, it's at times every 2, maybe 3 hours for a bus into town, and the bus is packed every time. And for someone just looking at that, and I'm aware that there are times and routes that will be empty, but looking at that, it just kind of screams, this route is profitable. Why like try and reduce the amount of service when we've got so many issues? Like, maybe I should lay out the like underlying problems with that we have, that we kind of have to deal with, and that personally I feel we're not addressing, is that Belfast is the most congested city per person in the UK. Our road infrastructure isn't built to handle the amount of traffic that's going in and out of Belfast now every day, and that's understandable. Like, we're a small city that's got a growing population, especially since we've had an influx of people coming from the EU, and post Troubles, we've generally had people wanting to stay in Northern Ireland and work in Belfast. Like, our economy is incredibly centralised. We've got a road infrastructure, like I said, that can't deal with it. We've got bus lanes being installed and put in, which I'm all for, but we need to fill them with something. Because if you're just putting the bus lanes in, not improving the service at all, you're trying to incentivise people to use public transport because cars are worse, and that would just make people begrudge the service, both the road service, the infrastructure, and the public transport service. So, and you mentioned there, it's a catch-22 situation, but ultimately if we want to get to a point where we have maybe not a world-class public transport system, but at least one that's, like, up there with some of the best, even just in the UK, I feel like we need to push for that those incentives for people to want to use public transport. Like, I think that, and part of it in my mind is the fragmentation of TransLink. Like, it might all be owned by the government in a way as shareholders, but you have Gold Line, Metro, Ulster Bus, and NI Railways, and there's, like, essentially no crossover between tickets you can buy, between ways that you can, like, integrate services, and ultimately I think that just costs us people wanting to use the transport. It's so fragmented, even though it's all under one umbrella, and I struggle to see where we're going to push for it, because as the bus lanes increase, the traffic is just going to get worse, we don't have really very adequate parking facilities. And you see that, like, for example, around the Ulster Hospital in Dundonald area at the minute, there's just cars everywhere. Yeah. And if you're coming down the Lisburn Road, there's cars in every conceivable spot that isn't specifically a bus lane. And it destroys it because you're going from two lanes to one, essentially, the whole way down. And, like, where do you see this, like, a push coming from to deal with the issues that we have to? Because
it's interesting. I'll take you back to one thing. Have you ever looked at the number of people? This is modal shift. This is getting people out of their car into the bus. Yeah. Have you ever looked at how many people start to use their smart pass when they get their free smart pass at the age of 60?
It's probably astronomical.
The cars, the majority, 40% of the cars around the Ulster Hospital, not necessarily in the site because you have to pay for the parking there, but out on the roads, are people who are going into Belfast who are 60 plus, who have a free smart pass, who join the metro system at that stage. So people do, when they have free smart pass, they use public transport. The highest users of public transport are people over the age of 60 who have smart passes. Mm-hmm. So people will use public transport if it's free, if it's free. And that's where we have the problem. In Northern Ireland, we have a lot of people who their experience of using public transport are cramped buses when they're at school. Once they get a car age 17, that's it, they're off. They don't use public transport ever again. Why would you use public transport? Public transport is the second class form of transport in Northern Ireland. I am all for bus lanes. I am all for a reduction of cars. We have the new legislation that will be coming forward to say, you know, fossil fuel vehicles will be gone by 2040, I think it is. You know, 33. The Consumer Council did a piece of work before about car drivers to ask how many of them would even be prepared to move into public transport. And 33% in that report said, not a chance. We'll never move into public transport because it's smelly, it's dirty. I mean, I actually took a group of drivers on public transport and said, what do you think? And they're like, oh, I didn't know nobody smoked in the bus anymore. Of course, it's public space, you know, and there's nice seats and they actually are clean. And you're right, the route that you talked about from Cumber is packed because there are so few buses.
Yeah.
Now, if they put on one every 5 minutes, there'll be one person or less on a bus going through. So TransLink does have to be careful with its money because the amount of money that it does get isn't the total amount of funding they receive, as you understand. So the percentage that they get is not fantastic. They have to be as good with it as they can. And the best way they can do that is to make sure that the buses that are going out have passengers on them. And that's why you'll get them being a bit frugal with their routes. Now, people like myself, MLAs, councillors and so on, will go forward and say, hold on a minute here. This bus is packed. How are you supposed to get a wheelchair user on that bus or a person with a pram on that bus? Because it's already bummed. So if we can prove to Chris Conway and the guys at TransLink that there's a viable additional route that, or additional bus for that route that can be added on, we will do that. Where I did it actually with community transport was to say, okay then, I have access to smaller sized vehicles, minibuses. If we ran, instead of 52 seaters, what if we take it down to a small size bus? Is there a possibility then of daytime use, increasing the number of smaller sized vehicles, smaller number of people on them, and see if we can have efficiency saving, providing a route but using alternative modes. Now this is something that everybody thinks TransLink is the only public transport provider. Northern Ireland, 24% of Northern Ireland PLC is spent on transport. And that includes freight, you have our airports, trains, buses, all of that. Why are we doing it so badly? And I look, well, who has the biggest fleet of vehicles in Northern Ireland?
Uber?
No. Education Authority. The yellow buses. Yeah. There are far more yellow buses than any other fleet of type in Northern Ireland. Why are those buses sitting all summer doing nothing? Why are they sitting all evening doing nothing? During the day when the kids are at school, the odd bus is used to carry about school dinners or takes kids to swimming pools and stuff. But most of those vehicles sit about scratching. And it costs us, as the Northern Ireland ratepayers, £157 a day for those buses to sit doing nothing. So why don't we utilise the fleet that we bought? And I've been working with the integrated transport strategy for years now, and to be honest, it's very frustrating because you would love to get all the departments together, give them a good shake. Education Authority gets £77 million a year. That's equitable to what TransLink gets, just to take kids to and from school. They are our buses. They are our buses. We've paid for those buses and we're paying for those drivers, so let's use them better. The licensing is an issue. We need to sort that out. We need to ensure that those buses and drivers can be used for other purposes that suits the needs of Northern Ireland. We also then have health. Health are ferrying patients to and from hospitals. They're doing daycare work. You know, they're doing lots of stuff like that. So they have another fleet of vehicles. Are they doing appropriate transport planning? No, they're not. Neither is Education Authority. And that's where we have the Department of Infrastructure. We've got transport planners and TransLink. If all of those resources were brought together, Northern Ireland has no issue with the number of vehicles that it could provide on the road. How we're using them is pathetic. Really, really pathetic. And that's where I sit in the background and go, right, guys, I'm quite happy to talk to you all, but you have to come together. There has to be a way of us spending Northern Ireland money better. And if we do it better, then your route in Cumber, there could maybe be a bus every hour because we could go down to
smaller
used
to be, which is, the more frustrating thing is that there used to be.
There used to be.
And it wasn't like the bus was empty either.
Yeah, well, but the thing is, do we need a 52-seater for that? And we need to start to talk to people realistically about that modal shift. If people at the age of 60, when they get their free smart pass, move from their car onto public transport, then that shows that people are prepared to do that. How do we make it attractive to other people? Now, from my point of view, I would be a bit like you. I find it extremely frustrating because my life is not suited to the public transport timetable. The public transport timetable doesn't work for me. As I say, I live in a rural area. I would have to drive to get to the nearest bus stop. There's no parking at it. It's a stick in a hedge. It's useless. You know, there's no light at it. It's not good. It's not safe to get to. You know, there's a lot of problems with it. But if there was an appropriate park and ride, but to be honest, my closest park and ride is 15, 17 miles from my house and 5 minutes from my work. So Dundonald is the big park and ride, would be the closest one for me. To be honest, if they put it at the top of the peninsula, I probably would use that and then go on into it because it would be worth my while. But having it in Dundonald, it's so close to the city centre. What's the point? Why would you stop and spend another 10 or 15 minutes waiting on a bus to travel on into Belfast? Now, a lot of people use it because parking in Belfast is expensive. Personally, I would remove all car parking spaces for civil servants. I would remove all car parking, free car parking spaces out of Belfast. If you want the cars out of Belfast, you have to do something that doesn't encourage cars to be there. But because our public transport system isn't yet ready, then we have to have the parking spaces. But we need to be cleverer about it. You know, the money that comes in from car parking spaces is largely going to private companies. It's not coming back into Northern Ireland. You know, we need to be clever. And the park and ride system, I think, is a way forward. The Cars Glen one is a perfect example of a good working one. The one out at Lisburn, fantastic. Dundonald, sure, it's full all the time. But it's full all the time of quite a lot of people who work in the Ulster Hospital. Because the car park in the Ulster Hospital is too expensive. And you mentioned about the Ulster Hospital, the park and ride. I'm disgusted with how the health authority here has completely ignored how people get to hospitals. For instance, the new Ulster Hospital design, if they had designed the road layout within the hospital site to allow a bus to drive up to the new back entrance of the hospital and do a U-turn and come back out, say round a roundabout and back out again, then you wouldn't have people saying, I'll just take the car up because I can't walk up the hill to the new entrance. You could have got the bus up in and round. But because there was no cross-departmental consideration on that planning, it means then we have an Ulster Hospital site that you can't get a bus up to the entrance, so people take their cars and they'll park everywhere and anywhere. The Torbank School site, which is next door to the Ulster Hospital that was supposed to be released for a new mental health unit, what is it now? A car park, and it's full every day. So we're giving too much to the car. And as time goes forward, if we have this deadline of 2040, where fossil fuel cars have to go, electric cars are not going to be suitable. At this stage, they're not suitable for people like me, who does quite a lot of miles driving. So I would need to come to work and charge it up. You know, maybe by the time this comes along, cars will be able to have a longer journey, you know, life on their battery and stuff like that. There'll be more charge points.
Well, there's instantaneous charging technology, like theorised and whatnot. Yes. But yeah.
Well, we have different countries. Australia now has the electric buses that do long distance journeys and things. So fantastic options out there. But Northern Ireland's very far behind in all of this. So we need to be starting to consider now, what are we going to do? Because if people are wanting to use electric cars, okay, then that means charge points all over the place. Okay, we'll have to look at funding for that. But is it the cars that we want to get them into, or is it public transport? And that's when we need to really start working hard and putting investment into our public transport structure. We spend a lot less than England, Scotland and Wales in our public transport. We expect TransLink to turn profits and reduce their amount of money year on year. If we're realistic about this and we know that smart passes work, then what do we, as you said before, there are so many ticket options when TransLink catch themselves on. Something like an Oyster card.
Don't even start me on the ticket, different ticket, like the app the app that they, you can buy a day ticket for like metros, not for Ulster Bus. You can't buy singles returns. You can buy some Gold Line returns, and so like it's the like, I just want to slap the person who went, yes, let's have an app for some tickets. Yes. Like, it just seems like madness. And you mentioned there about the Smart Pass and the kind of Oyster card idea, and I know that there is like plans and sort of infrastructure being put in place, but what, that's like 4 or 5 years down the line at this point. I don't see there being a need for it to be high tech. There's a very easy, in my mind, low-tech solution to it that doesn't require the technological infrastructure, the sort of investment in the technology, the rebuilding of all the systems in the buses. Like, for example, I talked earlier when we were just chatting about Innsbruck, and they have like the most fantastic, they just have little cards that you can buy for 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months, 6 months, like a year, and everybody has them, like everyone. Yeah. And everyone uses the public transport because of it, because it's like, oh, you know, they bought it, and like within about 5 or 6 journeys, it's like practically paid for itself in like taxi fares or like petrol. And people just use the bus all the time because it's easier. And that's a point that I think we have to get to. Like,
but the other thing is the number of cars in that country are significantly less.
Oh well, I agree, but
the
reliability thing is such a huge issue. Like, and I'm gonna use a specific example again from me, but like I'll talk about like more broadly as well. In that, I live like a mile, maybe not even, from the centre of Cumber. Right, the bus takes 20 minutes to get to where I am, and it's because they take so long getting everyone on the bus with the change. And that's another thing that the card solution would solve, because it would just be flash card on. Well, it would save much time.
Translink do have the integrated ticketing system coming forward. The issue with it is the integrated transport strategy hasn't come alongside at the same time, because what we're trying to do with the integrated transport strategy is, Muggins here lives in a rural area. I know I need to drive my car to get to it, but what if there was an alternative local solution? So a community transport. So you'll get an Uber or a community transport or a taxi firm, all part of public transport. So my ticket, I go, right, I need to go, book it on, off I go, get onto the vehicle. It takes me to the Linked or the Hub or whatever it is. I get onto the public transport system and that takes me further. But it's that modal shift. So the integrated ticketing system should be one that will allow different operators, modal operators within along that chain to link in together. It could even involve e-bikes. You know, it could involve the Belfast City Bike Scheme. It could all be linked in together so that you have access with your ticket to the public transport system for Northern Ireland. It takes a bit of radical thinking in some people's parts, and it takes a number of departments to actually say, okay, that's a huge amount of my budget that I'm not relinquishing, but I'm enabling other people to have access to. And then we can have that multimodal. So you know that in the morning you'll have a 52-seater that will be leaving Cumber because there's lots of people who need to get to Belfast to go to work. Right, that's okay. 10 o'clock, not maybe so many people. Some people, maybe it does require a 52-seater. However, at 11 o'clock, you're talking maybe 10 people. At that stage, we know already that the Ulster Hospital has sent out a minibus to take people to the local day opportunities, people with learning disabilities, physical disabilities, and that's in the Phoenix Care Home in Cumber. Mm. It will have to come back to the Ulster Hospital. So on its way back, it becomes the public transport route, and those 10 people can fit onto those bus and show their pass, and off they go. There's a lovely piece of work was written by a guy called Barry... Oh, I can't think of Barry Stern. I think it's Barry... Funny enough, Barry White, but I can find out the name for you, who talked about this futuristic modal shift of transport where, you know, on that day he needed to go to a meeting and he knew he was going to be travelling a distance, so he was wearing a suit and he didn't want to use the bicycle to get to the train station, so he got the Uber type a taxi that took him along, but it ended up that the number of people at his stop at the train was only 4 people, so there was a car share scheme set up so they could go on so the train could carry on through and move. And it's very futuristic, but to be honest, it's a cleverer way of thinking. In Northern Ireland, everybody assumes that they will have to have a car and they will have to be paying insurance. And when you take into account the full cost of a car, it's not just whatever pence per litre that you pay today for your fuel. Mm. It's your insurance, it's your parking, it's the maintenance, it's all that stuff. When you add it all up and you do a cost comparison, TransLink still coming out about the same price. We need to make TransLink more cost efficient for people. And the only way to do that is to have more people using the vehicles, and that can create a bigger income for TransLink and then therefore make it a bit cheaper fare-wise. TransLink, to be honest, I know people do complain about their fares, but they actually don't have bad fares. If you looked at their operating costs, the amount of money, I have to say, it's a bit like Northern Ireland Water. Until you actually look at their business cases, they have streamlined their costs significantly.
Okay, you know, that's very fair. But then why are prices still rising year on year?
Because of the unprofitable routes. There are routes where they are losing thousands and thousands of pounds a day on. But they have to have them because it's our public transport and we want there to be routes.
I agree. But then when you're talking about trying to get incentivize people to use it, do you not think that the government should be pushing to front that initial sort of jump to where it becomes the cheaper and better option for people? And the reliability is also, in the sort of stigma around it, is also a big issue that needs to be addressed. Like for example, personally, I used to have to get the bus that would have been 1 hour before the one I thought I should get to get into town. So say I used to work in Sapphire Restaurant up the Lisbon Road as a bartender, and I would say if I had to start at like 11 o'clock, okay, there would be a bus that would maybe get me into town for about 10:30, maybe 10:40. But I did not get that bus. I had to get the early one because there was 9 times out of 10 I would arrive late. And it's so frustrating, and honestly, I would deal with it if the timetable was honest. And I've never, ever, I don't think, arrived in Belfast like when I need to be in town and get public transport at the time it says on the timetable it's going to get me there. And it needs to be, and I honestly think that could be one of the biggest issues is the reliability, is that people just see it and be like, oh.
But this is the catch 22, because in order to get the reliability, we need to get other people in their cars out of the bus lanes. And in order to do that, we're building rapid transport at the moment, and the rapid transit system will be that enabler. Mm. And you see now all, because this is, TransLink's actually set themselves up almost for a fall, because you'll see now the digital readouts, you know, bus coming in 2 minutes and all, and you see the timetables beside it. That's what they're trying to achieve, but we can't achieve it because of car users. Because car users are sitting in bus lanes, holding things up instead of giving us that rapid system that means that they can stick to the timetable. So when people say, oh, it didn't arrive exactly on time, that's because of our congestion, because of car. It's not because of us, it's because of car users, and car users who are in bus lanes. So now we have the system where the fines are in place and people are trying not to use bus lanes and everything's cracking up.
Like, one issue I find with the bus lanes is that they're there for maybe four or five miles, maybe like even a half a mile, and then they disappear for a little bit, and then everyone just like floods back in, and then it's like, why is the bus lane there in the first place?
Well, with the new rapid transport system, you won't have that filtering back in again. It will be a dedicated bus lane, and there's nobody to go into that. In fact, if there's any cars parked in it, they'll get towed. Because this is a dedicated system. Now, we didn't go down the route of the tram lines, but we do have buses who'll be running along that.
And we should never have taken them out.
To be honest, I agree with you. If we had have kept our train lines and we'd have kept our tram lines, then we would have had so much more options. But everything's geared towards going to Belfast. The other thing we need to think about is, why is everybody going to Belfast? Well, Belfast is the centric, you know, business area of Northern Ireland. But what about the rest of us? We're all travelling into Belfast. We're encouraging people to do that. Is there any way we can bring business out? We can encourage that development, you know, to radial out from Belfast. Not to take away from Belfast. Belfast is amazing, and the city has developed so much. When I was a student, you know, it's incredible. It's wonderful to see the change in it. And of course, not having the troubles has encouraged investment. Yeah. But we're radiating towards Belfast, and there's plenty of other areas that we need to push out to. You know, you're talking about over 900,000 people congregating in one place in Northern Ireland on a daily, Monday to Friday basis. We need to take it out, because you have to think about the rural areas. Well, rural areas, I get complaints from a 16-year-old who's not allowed to drive yet, who can't go out on a Saturday to their Saturday job. When they go out to their Saturday job, they're spending the first 2 hours earning money that covers their taxi fare to get there, because we've no public transport for it. If we radiate it out, then we encourage services to come out, and we could encourage TransLink to do more outside the area. But it's all to do with transport planning, and it is chicken and egg. We need that modal shift. We need people to stop using public spaces like the Ulster Hospital as a car parking zone. I travel many, 95% of my journeys, I am on my own in the car. And I know that civil service tried the car share model. To be honest, they did not really promote that well enough. They tried very hard, but it didn't work. Everybody in Northern Ireland likes to be in their own car, has the flexibility of having their own space, being where they want to go, run out, get into the car to run 2 miles down the road to get a sandwich. You know, it's that flexibility is there for them, and that's not going to change. I think the 2040 deadline will change it for a few people. We also have an increasing number of people who cannot use cars. So you have a number of people with disabilities and older people who have their licences revoked, or did they decide not to drive because of ill health or, you know, age. And because roads are so much faster and busier than they were when they started to drive. So there's a growing number of people who want to use public transport. So that's why I believe we have to keep public transport there for those people who don't have other options. If you're blind, you can't drive, you need public transport. You know, there are
people would maybe argue that some of the drivers are, but
but mind you, I've just come back from experiencing travel in Cairo, and my goodness, what had two lanes, there were six, you know, cars abreast across it. It was unbelievable. So our traffic here is incredible. Belfast congestion happens because of several reasons. There's a lot of cars coming into the one place, all looking to be there at the same time. Have you thought about during the day in Belfast? Why is there a lot of cars driving about Belfast during the day? It's supposed to be, I've heard it in reports before, that 60% of the daytime traffic in Belfast is caused by the hospitals. People travelling to and from appointments and between hospitals in Belfast, so the Royal to the city and so on. A lot of that is to do, so we need to think up more carefully about how our services are provided. Why are we forcing a rural dweller who lives 30 miles outside of Belfast to travel into Belfast for a 9 o'clock appointment in the middle of rush hour? If we made their appointment at 11 o'clock, then that would take the pressure off. Schools are all at the same time as people are going to work. Now, I'm not proposing that we all of a sudden change schools to start at 8:30 in the morning or 9:30 in the morning, but we have to think cleverly about this. Those school kids are all on buses. They need the bus lanes. They need to be able to get out of the way, out of the car's way. There will always be people who will need cars. So there are people who, for whatever reason, could be disability. It could be because of their job, the type of work that they have. They need to have the flexibility of getting out and run about during the day. But for those people, fine, you've got your cars. There'll be a limited number of car parking spaces for you, but for everybody else, get out of the bus. It's time for us to start to recognise public transport as not being the second class form of transport, make it first class. And a radical idea that was put out is, if SmartPass has been proven to create that modal shift, why don't we just, as Northern Ireland, invest in SmartPasses for all citizens? And then you free public transport. It's a bit like health free at the point of use. Mm. And we do that. And we see if that works. Would it work?
Well, I would 100%.
But we couldn't afford it because we...
I know we couldn't afford it, but like, this is why actually that's why we sort of put together that idea whereby people can pay for a pass that would just cover all transport in Northern Ireland, £200 or £300 a year. And
I have a problem with that because there are a lot of people who use public transport who couldn't afford to pay. They maybe are paying it over the year, but they couldn't do it up front all at once.
Well, then you sort out some form of like monthly payment system for people who want to do that. I think that criticising the bulk payment...
Tax. Why not do it through tax?
You could do it through tax. You could give people tax credits. You could, you know, there's so many ways you could do it. It's just about, in my mind, making it easier for people to use public transport just like that. It's like, oh, if I got the change, oh, I've only got 3.80, the return's £4. Like, you know, the sort of hassle that people go through, and then, you know, you have a £10, you get scowled at by the bus driver. but actually, something I wanted to ask your opinion on was the routes that we have. Just, you've talked about the sort of rural routes and the need to reorganise and dialogue things, but arguably part of the problem is that you have Belfast is the be all and end all of where the routes go. Everywhere starts from the city centre and out and into the city centre. Yeah. And I've seen quite a few different transport systems where it's not a like rural to city centre system. It's either London has it with the tube. It's like a end to end from one side of the city to the other, and then the end points are at the rural parts, and they make their changes there in turn. And that would arguably free up space in the city centre. It would improve the rapid, people's ability to get across town.
The rapid transit system is proposing to do that. So it's starting in Dundonald and it's ending in, depends which route you go on, it ends in Cullen Glen.
Okay.
So that has the opportunity of creating that for Northern Ireland. If you think about outside of that again, the normal commute in Northern Ireland, or the average commute in Northern Ireland, is 25 miles. So you're, and there's people who do a lot more. And
the metros don't go 25 miles. Like I live pretty close to Belfast, yeah. And I'm horrendously serviced, yes. Like in Cumber. Like, and that's not very far from town. Like.
But that's where you have to think about. So when you go outside of the metro system, that's why you have things like, so at the minute we have metro. What happens outside of metro? Have you looked at the investment that infrastructure does outside of metro? So you've got the Ulster bus system that does the main corridors, the route corridors, which will be urban to urban, so it's town to city, town to town.
Yeah.
But what happens with everybody who doesn't live in that, who are outside of that? And that's when you have their investment in the Rural Transport Fund. And the Rural Transport Fund is the one that gets community organisation to bring people together. What unfortunately has happened is there are some people who will need to have that support transport from door to door. But that can't happen for everybody, so it's that you can go from, I'll take you from your house to the local bus station or the local train station and off you go. In the west of the province, you mentioned the word trains and they look at you and go catch yourself on, because unless it's along the north coast, there is no such thing as trains, it's all buses. Buses need to use roads, but do we need to be building all these big massive roads? Well, it's all to do with commuting, it's all to do, you know, we're spending money on roads instead of spending money on public transport. Public transport certainly does need to use a road. But does it need to have four lanes? Not necessarily. What we're doing in Northern Ireland is we are creating more roads for more cars. We need to get more people out of their cars into the buses. How do we do that? We need to look at humans. Get it back to basics again. Okay, there's me. Why can I not use public transport? Well, I have the issue of I live in a rural area and I can't get to the bus. I'm going to get to a bus stop. There's nowhere to park. Sure, the park and ride is so close to my work. Why would I not just take the bus? Plus, I'm also a mum. My childcare, I don't have, if there's something goes wrong, I need to get back home as quickly as possible. The flexibility doesn't seem to be there for public transport. Mm. Has public transport ever sat down and asked me about that?
Probably not.
So that public consultation.
Well, they published that. They published their kind of like a public opinion of TransLink every year, and always seems to be like, and I really want to know who they asked, because no one I know has a good opinion of TransLink.
They have a few forums that they have, and then they do customer surveys and things, and you're right, it's all about 93% cleanliness and all this sort of stuff, and they do come out very well for the people who are sitting on the buses, but they don't ask the person that's sitting beside the bus in the car,
yeah,
what do you think of that? And that's where I have to say, we need to have that sort of examination. I know the Consumer Council in Northern Ireland did do a bit of work asking questions, why do you not use the bus? What would encourage you to do so? And there's a list of things that everybody can come up with. You could do it off the top of your head. Cheaper fares. If I was to ask a car driver in the car beside me, what is the fare from where you left today up to Belfast? They couldn't tell me. The assumption is it's very expensive. No, it probably is. But there's so many tickets, it's too confusing to find out.
Yeah, exactly. And like, for example, I'm about 2 miles maybe from like the very, very furthest out metro stop from where I live. So like I'm walking about half an hour, or there's a bus that comes every couple of hours past me with the Ulster bus. So it's a free return basically on the Ulster bus now, isn't it? It's like £3 from where, yeah. I am, and you can have a return for £3. Fantastic, right? That's so much better. So if I walk the 30 minutes to where the metro is, if I want to get a return, it's £4 because it's a day ticket. And like,
it's just I don't know
like who is sitting round like making the decisions about the ticketing. Like in my mind, it just needs to be super simplified, because I feel that you would get more education about it. Like the people would just know, because they're constantly running different offers and different passes, different like just like.
But you have to think, TransLink are doing this on their own. What I say constantly is, can you imagine if when you got your hospital appointment out, on the back of the letter was the timetable for the buses and a voucher? You know, because they will pay for some people who are on benefits and so on, when they go to the hospital, they pay for their mileage, or they'll pay for the bus ticket. But the person has to pay that first before they get the bus ticket. So instead of giving them the timetable and giving them, say, a voucher to use on the bus, look, there's people who will use the bus, you know, so they're paying it anyway.
Yeah. And they're so close to being there with the app. They just need to make it like, so I think it's if you buy a certain ticket, it has to be validated within 20 minutes to use.
Okay.
Like that could be done for every single route.
Yeah.
Like and they have the technology there, which is, that's the most frustrating bit. They don't need And I agree that the Oyster card system is eventually the way we need to go, because London's system is... Londoners complain about it, but if you're coming from Belfast and you go to London, you're just like, it's just like mind
blown. You don't need to have a car when you live in London. No, you don't. Because you can get around anywhere. But it's that sort of system. But you have to remember the technology behind that, because I've seen the sort of how the background works. Is like, for instance, when I worked in community transport, I could have told you the person who got on my bus today, I could have told you their Section 75 background, because they would have been registered with me and I could have known their details from it. So I knew on that bus, there could have been 70% of that bus was full of Protestants, Catholics, older women, children, whatever it was.
Mm.
And that all is needed for Northern Ireland's grants and funding system. It tells you all of that. It also tells you, you can sort of guesstimate where somebody's going. So they're getting off the Ulster Hospital. Well, you can sort of put two and two together. They're either going to work in the Ulster Hospital or they're going to the Ulster Hospital to get treatment. So it's the reasons for travel. And then you can start to say, well, what are the right reasons for travel? Where are people going to? Morning times and afternoon times, it's going to be school and work. During the day, where are people going to? What are they using the buses for? Is there any way that we can look across departmental-wise to see if there's anything? So if we're talking about access to services, you know, are we using our public transport system appropriately to make sure that people are given that opportunity? Are children at school being taught how to use the public transport system outside of, you know, being at school and using public, where they're lifted and laid by a school bus? Are we teaching parents that
could we give children all just, I just had that like, why not, if you're under 18, why are you not just giving a bus pass?
Well, you see, this,
and then you'd encourage people to learn to use the buses, but like, you wouldn't need to give them the education.
Well, this is the thing about parents, you know, instead of little Johnny or Mary getting a car license at 17 or 16 and a half, as it's going to be, you know, why don't we encourage them, here's your bus. In fact, I have a niece who's just about to head off to university, and my present for her to go on is a Y-Link card to get her up to Jordanstown, because it'll make sure that she's not out of pocket, that I'm going to be the favourite aunt, but she's not having to buy an old banger and being dangerous on the road with it. You know, I'm encouraging her to use the bus. It's not automatically to go to the car, and that's something we need to consider. And the more people we have, then the more evidence there would be for somebody like me as an MLA to go to Translink and say, can you put another route on? I've proved you. That's what I did as community transport. What we would have done was we would have run a route for 3 months with a smaller sized vehicle to see if we could generate the bodies. And if we could prove that there was bodies there, then we would hand it over to Translink and say, we've proven the route for you, there you go. We did a system, unfortunately, where people were complaining that they couldn't get to Alton the Galvin Hospital for appointments. Translink put on a bus route. We tried to have the feeder system in. There was hardly anybody who used it. So
what do you think the problem was there?
Do you know what? It was because they didn't want people who were working in the hospital. It was only for people who were attending appointments. You know, if they'd done it the other way around, then it might have been better. But it's difficult because we need people to understand that encouraging use of public transport, we encourage the whole lot. It's not we know that there's going to be daytime times when the buses aren't going to be full. There are other fleets of vehicles that we could perhaps use to handle that. You know, it's just how we use our system. If we really, really wanted to concentrate on public transport, we might have to consider, as you have said, you know, reducing the amount of money that people pay directly, but they're paying for it through their rates because it's going to have to come out of the public purse.
Yeah, but it feels a lot less.
Yeah.
It but feels like a lot less when that's happening.
But when you have something for free, it tends to be abused and people don't use it. If somebody pays something for it, they expect a better service and they expect to get services on time. So I think there still needs to be a fee there. But
no, that's fair enough. Like, there's very few public transports in the system in the world that are completely free.
Completely free.
Like, you go argue the Dutch one is, but that's only if you don't buy your ticket because they don't have any attendance. But,
as well as this, in Northern Ireland we have where health is protected and education less so but still protected. If we're protecting those two enormous budgets, then we don't have the money, to be honest, to go into infrastructure. So we need to think about
If only we had suddenly come into a lot of money.
Well, the lot of money that we're coming into is all segmented already, and was segmented in that agreement.
Is transport getting any?
It's getting some.
Some.
But the wealth of it will go to our protected services of health and education. But education.
Well, not that the health service doesn't need the money, but they could spend it a lot better.
They could spend it.
Stop sending one sixth of it to management consultant firms, probably.
Health could gobble up every penny you give it every single day. On acute services, we need reform in health. And one of the reform in health, I would say, is to look at health and go, why are you running transport services when you're not a transport provider? Why not give it over to infrastructure to look at and transport plan better for you?
They could probably reap some sort of financial reward for it, which would help plug some of the budget gaps.
And it's all due to the licensing. At the moment, they're not allowed to collect fares off people, but that licensing could be changed around. Yeah.
Okay. Well, then, so ultimately, it comes down to, as it often does in Northern Ireland politics, a lack of maybe common sense and a lack of cooperation.
Do you know what it has been? And I have been on record in this place before I became an MLA. It was silo mentality for years. You would have had ministers from different parties who would never give up any of their budgets to another party, or maybe another minister who was a different party. And this silo mentality went on for years. During our integrated transport strategy, I was extremely disappointed that instead of waiting, the Department of Education did their 10-year home-to-school transport strategy and basically removed themselves out of the integrated transport work that we were doing. That could have brought all of those fleets of vehicles in together and created a system that was workable for Northern Ireland. It would have allowed Translink to do the main routes with their big buses, and we could have had filtered in, you know, and lots of flexibility for people coming to and from. It would have been wonderful. But no, they went on ahead on their own. Now we have the new programme for government coming forward, which is an interesting one because it's cross-cutting and it forces departments to work together. So you may well have infrastructure is in charge of access to services, which also talks about education and health and communities and housing and all. So the whoever's going to be in charge, whatever permanent sector, it could be Peter May of infrastructure, will have to report across all of those to make sure that there is joined up thinking. And that doesn't necessarily mean that we say to education, give up your £77 million for your education transport budget. What we're saying to them is, no, what we need to do is utilise your resources a lot more efficiently. So that, I'm hoping, will cut that down, because the silo mentality has been atrocious for years and it has held us back. It really has held us back. When you get departments working in isolation, then they don't get it.
Well, that's kind of a result of the system we have set up, and the kind of Dahan allocation of departmental ministers. And it means that each like department and party are like forcefully defending their area of expertise, and that's their thing. Yeah. They're sat like a little, it's mine, trying to essentially keep people away.
I'm protecting my little bubble.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
Where you would have, to be honest, there were some ministers over the years who were big enough to turn around and go, actually, this is better for Northern Ireland. And I'm hoping now
the Chuckle Brothers.
Well,
if you want to go to the really huge, yeah, huge
well,
example
I've
of
seen
that.
A few transport ministers over the years who have been willing to open discussions and move down different routes. It takes a big person to be able to turn around and say, actually, this is what we're supposed to be doing here. You know, it's for the benefit of Northern Ireland. Let's talk seriously about this. So we did the integrated transport strategy, straddled across a number of ministers, but that was an interesting concept. For the first time, I sat around a table and they didn't walk away with education, health, infrastructure, community and voluntary sector, private sector, taxis, all sitting talking sense about transport, knowing that there's only a small amount of money. There isn't a magic money tree in Northern Ireland, and that small amount of money had to be spent better.
I just aside there, that is the, like, as much as I think it was a ridiculous phrase, like that is the best example of how phrases can like infiltrate the like political conversation. Just like it's utter rubbish. Like it's such a stupid phrase, but it's every single person who has watched any sort of politics, news, anything in the last 6 months, they know exactly what that means.
Yes, exactly. But we genuinely, the money that we get from Westminster is going to be stretched and it's going to be cut. You know, as we move with, I was a Remainer, I didn't want us to leave Europe. 2019 is looming very close. There, to be honest, as a Remainer, what I find very difficult is actually moving out of Europe gives us the freedom to create transport legislation that makes for better transport for the United Kingdom.
This is like the kind of upside of it, but
yeah. There's regulation, EU regulation 1071 and 1073, in particular are quite restrictive in operator licensing and driver licensing and so on. Now I'm not talking about eroding anything that would cause road safety issues, but it's just there are certain limitations there that we could actually, if we were to sit back with a clean sheet of paper and say, how are we going to work this? You know, if you had to do Northern Ireland again, how would you do it? You know, where would you put the roads? What would you do? And who would you allow to do certain things? Then that, we have the freedom to do that. It's very sad for me because Europe, some of the regulations and the guidance and the legislation for transport was fantastic, and I hope we keep those elements. But some of it was very, very restrictive. Very restrictive.
I guess it's the same as any part of the EU, like it comes with both, you know, great like help in protecting people's rights and protecting certain areas of infrastructure or government or, you know, anything. But then there's obviously, you know, regulation has its downsides as well.
Yeah, that's the thing, because when you think about Europe is trying to sort regulations across all of the countries of Europe, and unfortunately Northern Ireland being on the periphery of the UK, on the periphery of Europe, some of the legislation on transport meant that we had very, very isolated rural areas with people who used huge style wheelchairs who couldn't be accommodated within that sort of legislation, and unfortunately were being left out. So we were trying to do things with community and voluntary sector organisations. We were trying to do things, you know, like the integrated transport strategy, because Northern Ireland is, I know that a lot of people live in around Belfast, but it's quite a rural area, and we can't forget about those rural people. And rural
we do have like a reasonably sort of spread out population once you get outside of Belfast.
That's it. And if we're going to have public transport, you can't just have it for one part and forget about the rest. So some of the restrictions caused difficulties for us, and I think that there was a few civil servants who were a bit reticent of pushing the boundaries on that. Otherwise we could have had something a bit more flexible to meet our needs.
But the minibus service that's set up there, that they're going to be running Belfast to Derry, that private company whose name escapes me right now, is, I think, a very interesting step towards the potential for that being used. You're talking about smaller services. Do you think that there could be sort of private companies running those sort of minibus services to really like supplement almost TransLink in a way? Do you think there's a way that they could do that? They're running private companies that could still be integrated to, within the public transport sector?
Absolutely, we can do that. There's actually the bus challenge a lot of years ago that DRD ran at that stage, and this was to enable public or private operators to come in and deliver routes to supplement TransLink, especially on the busier routes and things that got there. It only existed while there was subsidy, because as soon as the subsidy went, the private operators went, "I'm not making enough money out of this, I'll pull out of it." However, in the local authorities, there's a bit of a difficulty. Northern Ireland does have different transport legislation than the rest of the UK. And in our legislation, we have the Section 10B permits that are community and voluntary sector minibuses. You've got your operator licence for your private commercial sector. You've your taxis and Ubers. They're still fighting their battles. So we have all of that going on. That's okay. But in England, they have another thing called the Section 22 permit. The Section 22 permit is for the, they had to bring it in, for the economically unviable routes that nobody else wants. And that is where commercial operators or community operators could come in, bid for those routes, and would be subsidised to keep doing that. So there is the opportunity to do this.
Arguably, that's not really working in England in the sort of reliability of companies like Southern Rail or Riva.
Well, it's because how it's worked in England with this, there was a model called the CanGo model in Hampshire County Council, and basically that was a smaller sized vehicle that did sort of sweep around the rural areas and come into a town, and it was a regular service. It was subsidised by the local authority to keep that rural route going, and it was done by a community organisation actually, and then I think there was a commercial operation did it at one stage. The longevity and keeping it going is only there while the subsidy keeps going, so it's all to do with government investment. So you could have a private company. The problem is in Northern Ireland, when somebody applies to do a route, it has to be away from TransLink's route. It can't be within 30 minutes of one of their routes. It can't be along the same route. There's and that's part of the European limitations on that. You can't have that. We can't have gone as Northern Ireland and said we would like to have a public corporation run on our public transport and make that exception for them to be able to do that, and then allow private operators to erode away that. So that's why there's certain regulations that limits what they can do. But what we find quite often is when somebody does propose a route, say for instance there's a business estate sitting outside of Craigavon or something, and they find that there's quite a lot of workers who don't have cars coming out of Portadown, going to Craigavon, going to this particular site, and a private company goes, you know what, I'll put a workers bus on there. They have to apply for a route to do that. And then you'll get everybody and his granny putting an objection to that route. TransLink's, you know, it'll be other private operators.
Surely TransLink shouldn't have a say in it as a conflict of interest.
They have to. They're one of the people that anybody can go against or for a route, you know. So they do have a say on that. And that's when it's up to the operator licence and the route licence and people to turn around and go, hold on a minute here, TransLink, what are you complaining about? There's a route there. There's been proven that there's a number of people there. It's not conflicting with your route. It's going to go on ahead.
If they really had an objection to the damage to their business, they would propose the same route. Yeah, exactly.
They just maybe haven't come up with it.
Anyway, we kind of touched briefly there on the running of Stormont, and I want to move on to that before we talk about transport all day. Well, what do you think is happening? There's Michelle O'Neill saying that, you know, they're ready to sit down, and the DUP being like, well, we said we were already ready to sit down. And to the outside, it just looks like a whole lot of posturing and nothing actually getting done. There's serious issues need sort of addressed in education, in budgets, in health, in transport even. Just there was, in dealing with emergency services, where there was, I cannot remember, the SDLP, Colin Eastwood, was saying yesterday after the floods, being like, where's the support? And it's like, well, governments falling apart. Like, where do you see the issue from maybe your point of view or the Alliance party's point of view?
Alliance is a devolutionist party, so we believe completely that Northern Ireland should govern ourselves, that we shouldn't be dependent on outside bodies to do that. Unfortunately, there are bigger pictures and bigger players in play here. So we do have DUP and Sinn Féin at the moment under the Good Friday Agreement. Because of the designation status, one of those two has to be able to go in and start off, you know, get a First Minister, a Deputy First Minister, and off we go. They are, I believe, putting party before country, and their constituents within DUP and Sinn Féin are forcing their hands a bit. The DUP and Sinn Féin haven't been really that available. We have been here, we've taken it in turn. We've sort of said to all of our 8 MLAs, right, tell us when you've booked any holidays, and, you know, you might be off 2 weeks, then you have to be in here for the rest of the 8 weeks, you know. We've kept it going that way. We've been available, we've been doing bilaterals, we'd actually be producing papers on Irish language and so on. Just try to give people alternatives to bring them out of their corners again. And it's been very frustrating. I know that Michelle came out and she said about, let's get back to the talks last week. We could have been talking all summer. The problem has been, there's no urgency on it. From those big parties, what is going to actually get them back? Are they committed to the Northern Ireland Assembly? The DUP lost 10 MLAs in the last Assembly election. That hurt them. They've £1 million of brand has been taken off the streets because they lost that number of MLAs. That's the not just MLAs, salaries. We don't get paid that amount, good grief. But their offices, their own staff, you know, it hurt them. It hurt them. And it
well, arguably they deserved it.
that would be very political. But Sinn Féin grew there, so they, you know, the balance is there. The petition of concern is now out the window because no one party has the right to be able to sign a petition of concern on their own.
Couldn't have been happier, but that was absolute silver lining of it's just that one party does not have that power anymore.
At the moment, if there's another Assembly election, that could change, because we saw in the last Westminster one, DUP got everybody and their granny out to vote and pulled an enormous vote out in the Westminster election. So they
but
could
do you think that I have trouble in trying to equate Westminster results to the local results,
yeah,
just because the system
it's first
is totally
past
different.
The post there.
Yeah, exactly. It's people are rocking up and being like, well, you know, especially people who are traditionally unionist voters, people who would maybe vote for Alliance in the Assembly elections. Like, I think you had the most first preference votes in Strangford, isn't that?
No, Simon Hammond actually had the highest number of first preference votes, but I was the first elected.
Okay. Then that is other proof that people are willing to put down alternative options. Yeah. And it actually shows you that people aren't as sort of stubborn as maybe it would suggest.
No, it's not stubborn. I think that what we have found with the last lot of elections is there's been a lot of dog whistleblowing and bringing out people based on cultural and traditional fears. And that's not good for Northern Ireland. When you come to local council elections and assembly elections, you do get people going, I like... In rural areas, they'll vote for the person, maybe the party second even. You know, they'll vote for the personalities. In urban areas, it's very much a party vote. But we are where we are. We're sitting here without an assembly. I have constituents on a daily basis, whether it's housing, health, special education needs, who need ministers taking and making decisions. We have civil servants who are it's basically like they're in a boat with one oar and they're keeping going, you know. Yeah. They're afloat and they're keeping things
to be fair around. I actually am thankful for the civil service at the moment, because as much as they kind of like run the show when the government is here, mm-hmm. in terms that they probably have more power than people realize to sort of make decisions themselves, if we didn't have them right now, we would be already at direct rule. Yep. Because things could not continue in any, like, and they're sort of stacking up at this point, and I feel like we're gonna, when the schools go back, mm-hmm. there's gonna be, and there's no all budget, there's gonna be.
Well, we do, there is a budget. The budget is there, and the legislation for the budget isn't there. So the money, people keep on, well, there's no budget. The money that we have, it doesn't matter if the Assembly come back in the morning, that is the money that we have. The Westminster's given us our money. Mm. It has been divided out. Stephen and I went along to the budget meetings, as did every other party. We went along to those meetings and we saw exactly what the recommendations were that would have been given to the Finance Minister. That was the way that the budget has been divided out. There's been protections for health and education because the public want that to happen. There's been cuts to departments all over the show. Health wanted a huge, millions and hundreds of millions of pounds more than they were going to be able to ever be given. And that's why we have the emergency meetings coming up later this week that are talking about £70 million cut to this year's budget, not next year, that in year, this year budget. So we're under an incredible amount of pressure with budgets. We need reform in Northern Ireland. We need people who will come back to the Assembly and have the bravery to turn around and go to the public. Look, I'm really sorry here. Things are really tight, but they're not giving us any more money. We don't make enough money in Northern Ireland. No. And this is what we need. And this is what you want us to prioritise. So how do you want us to spend the rest? You know, we do need to reform health. As sad as it makes me say,
oh, goodness me, yeah.
health needs to be reformed so that it can be sustainable in the long term.
We just, honestly, like, it might seem like a simplistic answer, but I feel that 90% of the problems could be sorted if you, like, restructured that management system that they have in place that was put in by the management consultant firms that the Tories brought in 2010. And they just suck money out of the budgets, just, and I know it seems like I'm just attacking management, but really, like, the NHS got run before by the people who were working in it. They got run by the sisters, they got run by former nurses, they got run by doctors. And for 50, 60 years, that worked.
Yeah.
There was nowhere near the level of, like, management pay that was spent, like, pre-2010. Like, people were talking about, oh, the NHS is in crisis during Labour's years. Like, my mum has been a nurse in the NHS for most of her working life, and she's not, like, anyone that's particularly high up. She's, like, band 6 and going for band 7. Like, she's switched on enough to realise that when they throw money at waiting list clinics,
yeah,
and then they like, oh, the waiting lists are down, and they just ignore what's causing the waiting lists.
That's why.
And then they just throw money at it.
That's why we need this fundamental reform. Like, for instance, at the moment, health needs a lot of money, even just to deliver acute frontline services. But what's happening is you have communities and you'll have infrastructure that's pulling back money for access to services. Community and voluntary sector services, the care in the community people. So what does that mean? That forces more people to go into the GP surgeries, to look for out of hours, to look for accident and emergency service, and puts all that acute pressure on hospitals again.
Yeah.
Because other departments are cutting down the very community-based services that could deal with some of this work.
Well, then you're putting more strain on the transport system. Like, again, it's a case of the bigger picture.
Yeah. Or health is going, actually, do you know what? We've day opportunities here and we need to get older people with disabilities out into those things. But if we just said that we don't deal with the transport stuff, somebody else can do that.
Mm.
Or domiciliary care services. So you've got somebody who's been prescribed for 24-hour care, or, you know, they're going to have a carer coming into them 2 or 3 times a day. The supplier's just pulled out and it's going to be too expensive for us to send our own staff down. Sure, the family can look after that for a couple of weeks until it gets sorted out. That's not fair.
No.
You know, the person is the vulnerable person is the one that's been left behind on that. Mm. And that's something we will be pushing for. But I have to say, from Alliance Party's point of view, our problem is we need a devolved government. We need ministers here taking and making decisions. We would be quite happy, and we said it in our last manifesto, to sit down with all the parties, not have bickering, and agree to do those hard reforms. But we need people to stop playing games.
Yeah.
So that if a hospital has been identified for part closure or closure, that we don't all turn around and the local person go, oh, isn't this terrible, this is wild altogether. We have to be grown up about this and say the reason why it's closing is because it's not able to give a good enough service. We can't attract the doctors to it because they're all going to the bigger hospitals. It's not good enough. So therefore, we're removing that. Yes, you might have to travel another 5 miles to a hospital, but this one will serve a better purpose. And we'll
but there's no reason that those sorts of systems can't be, that a lot of the problems can't be dealt with that you would maybe see people going to hospital for in community care centres.
Yeah, there are some, but people don't know this. You know, you can go to, today you could go to your GP, you could go to your pharmacist, you can go to lots of different options. ARDS, accident and emergency, or sorry, it's the minor injuries unit, sorry, it's called an ARDS hospital. You could walk into that today and have an x-ray done without having to go to the GP. You know, you've hurt yourself, it's a minor injury, they'll go and x-ray you. They'll tell you whether or not you broke something. If you have, they'll send you to the hospital. If not, they'll wrap you up, give you a few paracetamol and send you home. That takes that person out of the system. The place is sitting empty because nobody knows to go to it. It's open 9 to 5. If it was maybe open 9 to 8, 9 to 9, working with people, you know, being around the time the kids get home from school and that's when they fall off their bikes, you know, all that sort of stuff. That's the time that we could take the pressures off. And it's about working with what suits the population and instead of doing this 9 to 5. Now, hospitals don't work 9 to 5. Hospitals work 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Yeah. They never stop, and neither do the staff.
Jeremy Hunt's comments were horrendous. Absolutely.
Yeah. Like
I said, my mum's a nurse, so I've met many nurses, and they were furious with him. Like,
Think they close the doors at 5 o'clock on a Friday evening or something? Stupid. Stupidity. Yeah. It's a all year round service. How the clinics are run is slightly different, you know, and how the waiting lists are managed is slightly different. We need to get this sorted out. And there are another strategy, Bamford, which is not bad actually, that gives us solutions to be able to do this. We need to sit down and work through that, and we need all parties to come together to do that. Now, if we go to direct rule, the same would happen as happened the last time. It just goes into a tick box exercise where nothing majorly changes. No. There's no innovation, no. And they'll keep going as long as they can keep going. I was working in transport the last time that we had a direct rule minister, John Speller, and he didn't rock the boat. There was nothing. It was the civil servants giving him ideas, and not too much more happened, and we stagnated under it. I don't want direct rule. Now, some people would say, as Alliance, direct rule would solve a few of your problems because you could have socially progressive legislation brought through, for instance, like same-sex marriage or women's rights and things like that could come through.
There's no reason that can't be dealt with.
That could be done by our own assembly.
Exactly.
You know, I think that it's time, but my problem is that I'm not seeing any urgency from the other parties. They are bound to be the same as me. I am tortured with constituents coming in with real problems about health, education,
and housing. If you asked 100 people on the streets of Belfast today, and you went, do you think the MLAs deserve their salary while there's no government? Yes. I would honestly be super shocked if one person said yes.
Yeah. Like, well, it's...
And it's honestly, I think that I don't know what comes next in my mind, because if they manage to get into government and get things together, like, I think their reputations are so tarnished, and it's like it's turning the political, like the sort of attitude towards Stormont, it's becoming so toxic, but people won't change, like substantial amounts of people won't change their vote.
Yeah.
So you just get a smaller and smaller and smaller base of people interested in it, and it's the extremes and the fringes who are pushing for things in politics, and that's when you get the situation where parties are driven by party above people, because the majority of the public might think otherwise, but the base that's now being dragged out, like you said, to vote for them is really just, they're the ones that they're playing to.
But also in politics, we have to be very careful. Alliances, as you know, and those smaller parties, we don't actually have a seat at the executive table by right because we have too few MLAs, although we've been brought into the talks because we were there before.
Do you have more than...
We have 8. No, you'd need to have 10 to be able to get...
Do you have, how many do the UUP and the SDLP
10.
Have?
They have 12 and 10.
12 and 10.
Yeah,
okay.
So by right, we're not there, but we're the only cross-committee party that comes close to it. So we're sitting in the talks and being that balance. It has been indicated if there's going to be a coalition that they would prefer all 5 larger parties were there. But we have certain requirements before we would go back in. We didn't go back in the last time. We refused the justice position because we had certain asks that we needed to see progress on, and it wasn't happening. So we stood out. that meant that we stood outside of even opposition. We didn't take any money because morally it was just, and politically it wasn't right for us to do. This time we'll have a think about it and we'll see what's going to happen, but we need to get to that stage yet. But we are still at the table. What we're trying to do is to say to the DUP and Sinn Féin, you backed yourselves into these corners. It's time for you to come out. We're going to present you with papers, do whatever we can to help you, but we're not going to fix it for you. And what happens is we tend to be in front of TV cameras and radio and we speak. Now, if you notice, the rest of them are all very quiet. The big parties, when you look at how many times they're talking, it's the same during elections. If you go into the Strangford constituency and there's a hustings event, you'll find SDLP will be there, Ulster Unions will be there, Alliance will be there, there might be the Green representative there. You might have a Sinn Féin representative, and you never have a DUP representative because they just don't turn up. They don't talk to
people. Need to.
They don't need to. They just think that they can avoid everything.
Well,
but it's also they
electorally electorally, you know, you'd have to say that they don't need to.
Well, they don't need to. Well, they have a very strong power base in Strangford, but they don't like having to answer difficult questions. So
yeah, but,
why be embarrassed?
But yeah, but again, the electorally, like, no one's holding them. No one's being like, well, you know, they didn't turn up to the hustings. I'm not going to vote for, like, that's not something that happens. So like, arguably, they have no need
but
to.
But
like,
in
terms
same.
Of serving their constituents, they have the absolute need to. But
well, this is the thing. At the moment, MLAs, I am flat out, I have to say, with constituency work, it doesn't stop. It just keeps going and keeps going. And the number of people coming through the door needing more and more help, especially now with the universal credit coming forward and lots of changes happening with the benefits system, lots of problems happening with housing at the moment. Loads of stuff coming forward. We need ministers to be taking making decisions. We don't have that. So my urgency is based on the fact that I see the people on the ground that have been, that you elected me are looking for help, who didn't even elect me, people who would never vote for me are coming shouting, screaming that they need help. And we're not providing it. We go so far and then we hit this brick wall with civil servants saying we need a minister to take a decision on that. The other two parties don't seem to have that urgency. And I don't know.
Could James Brokenshire approve things? Or is that kind of...
There's some issues that are devolved matters. For instance, when universal...
But like if we... But I mean, if we have no government, is there no provision
there,
for...
There is still... In the interests of Northern Ireland, there will be decisions that the Conservatives won't want to take for us. For instance, I was just going to say there, universal credit.
Okay.
Comes in Northern Ireland. When the welfare reform stuff came through, which nobody wanted, we voted against it in Westminster, it came into Northern Ireland, but... The last action of the Assembly was to put in protections in place for the bedroom tax, so that in Northern Ireland the government would pay the bedroom tax rather than people having to pay that extra money.
Okay.
The universal credit comes forward. You need the piece of legislation to come in to make sure that we have that mitigation for people who are on universal credit. For the Conservatives to bring in Northern Ireland mitigation for the bedroom tax, then you would have all of their constituents in England, Scotland, Wales going, hold on a minute here, you just did that in Northern Ireland, what about us? So they're not going to do that. So we need Northern Ireland politicians to do that. DUP are going to vote with the government. They've already said that's part of their agreement. So they're not going to vote against the Conservatives or fight with the Conservatives about that.
As
so we have broken.
Might want them to.
So, but we do have issues that Northern Ireland politicians will take, like for instance, water rates. At the moment, nobody pays water rates in Northern Ireland. Well, businesses pay it, but no residential people pay water rates.
Yeah.
Now, we're all paying for it in our rates, but, you know, there isn't a separate bill for water rates. Brokenshire could bring that in the morning, but is he going to? He's not going to take risks. So that's what I mean about if direct rule, we do go to direct rule, it'll all fall. Now, remember, the way that Westminster works is, so we're coming to the end of the summer and we'll go back into some talk system. James Brokenshire's going to talk to us all about how this is going to work. I personally...
Oh, you mean like that last time he did that? And that, like, last time before?
Exactly.
And the
be
time
honest,
before that? And that
honest,
other deadline he set? And...
Yeah. To be honest, I don't think that there's no urgency with James Brokenshire. So
no,
I don't think that he has chaired any meetings so far. You know, he's been at meetings, but there's been no chairing happening. There's been nobody sitting there as an independent person going, really? This is what you're yapping about? You know, get your lives back together again, folk. You know,
man,
we have people...
I would personally crowdfund a campaign to allow me just to sit down with Arlene Foster and Michelle Neal and literally just slap them both across the face and be like, you agreed to the Irish Language Act, stop being such a prick. And you already verbally, like,
to be honest, the best thing too would be to put a TV camera in the corner.
I
TV camera in the corner, I think, the same as the Assembly Chamber, and let it be filmed, because
maybe then people would bring this forward. There are a lot of discussions need to happen privately, because there are arguments. We do have polarised parties here that do need to come together. But the word that's coming out of the talks is all nonsense. We need to move forward. I haven't seen
anyone say anything sensible. None.
Like, and it's all smoke and mirrors, because nobody wants to come out and say something. If somebody happens to raise their head above the parapet and mention something that was talked about in the talks, then they get absolutely slaughtered by the party. And it's like, oh, please, come on. The Northern Ireland public have no government here. We've no ministers making decisions. We need to move this forward. Mm. Now, from the Alliance Party's point of view, this isn't sustainable. I worked in the Committee on Voluntary Sector.
I don't think you'd find anyone who thought it would be, who thinks it would be.
But there seem to be other parties who think it is. Mm. They're quite happy for this status quo to continue. I don't think it's sustainable. The party doesn't think it's sustainable. We know at some stage the public is going to say enough is enough. Mm. You know, my problem is I have.
When you get to that point and the public.
To be honest, the
public throw up their hands and then they get to the voting booth and they're like, oh, well, you know, I'll just vote DUP anyway.
But if there's
a. You know that, like, vote, I just. I you know, don't see.
Robinshire has to call the vote. Is he ever going to do that? You know?
But, like, what do you see as the consequence for Sinn Féin and the DUP? Because.
There's no consequence.
Yeah, that's my point, and that is what I see as the problem.
Yeah.
They have no they have no desire, in my mind, to do anything, because they're not going to face electoral consequences.
No, but they're not going to face electoral consequences, but Brexit's coming. Brexit's coming in 2019, and you have to think about that.
Well, we don't even know if that's...
Well, no, Brexit is coming in 2019.
We might have transitional arrangements, we might have nothing, we might have... Well,
but as far as hearts and minds are concerned, you know, we've got this coming in 2019.
Okay.
The Conservatives have DUP who are going to vote with them, so they've got a majority in Westminster. They're not going to push for another election, given the what happened to them the last time. You know?
Oh no, they will.
If they can, they will
cling until 2022.
And to be honest, as far as the DUP and Sinn Féin are concerned, Sinn Féin did very well in the last assembly elections. DUP not so well. DUP don't want to risk anything. Now, they could do well in another election, but why risk that? So they're not particularly interested in an election. The Westminster, the Tories aren't particularly interested in another election.
Oh,
it's £5 million, that's the price of a primary school. They're not going to go for that. So what's going to happen? We can't go on as we are with no government in Northern Ireland, but I'm not seeing any urgency from the other two. Sinn Féin say that they want to get back, but there are certain things that they need to see. To be honest, Alliance is saying there's certain things we need to see. SDLP, Alliance are producing papers left, right and centre to try and get everybody to consider petition of concern and Irish language options, and lots of stuff like that.
But honestly, like, the Irish language thing is this huge, I think, just invented bogeyman. It's
well, it is for Irish language speakers and from the Alliance
but
parties.
Like is it the St. Andrews Agreement or the Good Friday Agreement that there has to be an Irish language act in it? Which one is it?
I think it's St. Andrews.
St. Andrews, right.
Dude, yeah.
Yeah, just like you've signed the fucking thing. Yeah. Like,
it's there. Alliance Party has said very clearly, absolutely no problem with an Irish language act. It's not going to force, I'm dreadful at all languages, being English. You know, it's not going to make me have to learn Irish. Yeah. But for Irish speakers, it is something that is fundamental to them and to the culture and, you know, about everything. There are some asks that some of the organisations that are pushing for an Irish Language Act that are not reasonable.
You don't have to entertain all those decisions. Yes. Just like literally just put it in place. Like, it's not like there's a huge cost. It's not like it's...
But the problem has been, you see, that there's a lot of smoke and mirrors here. Mm-hmm. Instead of Sinn Féin coming forward and saying, actually, you know, the synergy proposals that are there are great and it may well be there in the long term, but it's not what we're going to get right. So here's what we're proposing. They've never put that down. Mm. So the talks have been talking around this. DUP have unfortunately just put themselves into a bit of a corner on this one. You know, they're talking about an Ulster Scots Act. Well, fair enough. Ulster Scots is nowhere near where Irish language is. Ulster Scots is
about
culture.
Did they not
culture.
Have a department in before for Ulster Scots?
They had that an organisation.
Yeah, was it not just like burning money because no one ever contacted them?
But they were
them.
Doing a lot of stuff to do with, you know, culture. Okay. Ulster Scots is not just about words, it's about dance, it's about art, it's about, you know, life living as an Ulster Scot. So, okay then, if you want Ulster Scots, well, let's put proposals together for that. Nobody is saying that everything's off the table here. It doesn't have to be either or. It could be both. And that's what we're sitting at the table going, this is not more important than what's happening in health.
Exactly.
You know, we have a full population here who all need health. Mm. Irish language speakers need to be respected. That's fine. Ulster Scots, people want to be respected. That's fine. Right, can we move on? Right, what's next? Mm. Petition of concern. SDLP and Alliance have put forward two papers. None of the rest of them have. And that's what's being discussed about petition of concern. Our paper is more about we limit down completely the petition of concern to only ever be used on issues to do with legacy, with Northern Ireland legacy and conflict, to do with parades, flags, all that sort of stuff. Not to do with socially progressive things like same-sex marriage. Now, that has sort of, it's on the table for discussion. SDLP have come up with a slightly different human rights-based view.
Okay.
Where our concern is that every single item could be petitioned and concerned then because it's human rights, but we're having that debate, an open debate. It's a very progressive debate. Ulster Unionists sit their hands on the table. DUP, I don't know, Shinners are not bad. They're looking at both, at least they're trying and having a look.
Mm.
And SDLP and Alliance are talking because the petition of concern hasn't gone away. The petition of concern, while no one individual party can sign it, say for instance the DUP only needs a few more people.
Yeah, I was going to say they only need a couple of more extreme unionists from the UUP or
TUV.
Or TUV. Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
And Sinn Féin, again, all they need is a few people and they can have, of nationalist persuasion, and they can have a petition of concern. To be honest, the women in the Assembly now could have a petition of concern. You know, it's still a concern. We still need to think about protecting minorities. Do we get rid of it completely? Are we ready for that yet? I don't personally think so. That's why we're pushing for some protection there. But it needs to be done. But the thing about it is, all of this is all nonsense. We're all talking about instead of saying, we could do this when we're in the executive. We could do this as the Assembly. We don't need to be sitting outside huffing about this. We have RHI still bubbling along in the background. We have Brexit that is about to come forward. You know, there are so many big issues here that we need to be back around the table. But unfortunately, the two big parties don't seem to have any urgency. Sinn Féin could be looking forward to a Brexit. You know, a hard Brexit serves a purpose. DUP, I think if there's not going to be an election on the horizon, then there's no threat to the number of seats, so they could sit quite merrily. As a community and voluntary sector worker in the past, I've been sitting going, why are them lads up there getting paid?
Mm-hmm.
They're doing nothing. I have staff in my office and I have an office that needs to get paid for. Okay, I need that to happen because that's my constituency services.
Yeah.
That's what looks after my people from Strangford that need all of the housing and the benefits help that they get. As far as I'm concerned, I have to take it in the chin. I left perfectly good work and come up here, took the risk. If it happens that there's a percentage of my salary is cut, I'm not like it.
No.
My family won't like it too much either, but you know, I could completely understand that.
Mm-hmm.
How quickly that will happen is up to James Brokenshire.
Mm-hmm.
It's all in his hands, and I think that unfortunately James has so far been in the room, but not necessarily sitting around the table talking sense. He has very much put it back that, you know, you are the Northern Ireland people here, you need to sort this out amongst yourselves.
Well, I do kind of agree with him.
And that's, I agree with him too, but there's no deadline saying if you don't do it by this.
Well, that there is, but it's the arbitrary sort
very
of
much
words.
So,
you know, it's just like drawing it on a whiteboard, just rub it
we
out
need to have, we need to have something done. Now, we know that there's a few pressures coming up with regards to the budget legislation, but that's not until the new year. So it could drift on. Now, Westminster will come back for their 2 weeks in September and then they close again for the conference season. So it'll be October, I think, before.
Then we'll see our new Prime Minister.
Can you imagine?
Well, we interviewed the head of UK Progressive, the site and magazine, and it just went out yesterday, the interview. And he thinks that Theresa May won't survive conference season. And I'm interested to see if that'll material. I don't.
But
I
it could
think
be the same as Arlene with DUP. You know, she's a figurehead. You know, to get rid of her would be seen to be a bit of a slight. You know, but
no, I don't think that's. I don't think that's the issue. I think that there's no one there.
Well, that's
that
true.
She's now there, and let's be honest, 2022, she's gone. That's the very longest that she will survive.
Mm-hmm.
She, I don't see anyone on that front bench that has more credibility. Like, basically, I think that they'll keep her in there because she's a fantastic, like, head to just throw shit at.
Yeah,
you know.
That's it, and she's taken it. My goodness.
But right, I want to finish with one last question. Would just sort of take us back to, we were talking about the Northern Ireland Assembly dealing with the health service. I see it as, even if we have the Assembly back and making decisions and trying to reorganize, even if we like put forward radical proposals. What's going on at the minute with the NHS across the whole of the UK with Theresa May back in the Naylor report, where there's just a fire sale, essentially was the term some few people have used, to like just selling off hospital grounds, offering services up to private companies and paying them off to run it. This just management culture and degradation of like frontline services in sort of exchange for ticking boxes at the top. All of it is and I feel that Northern Ireland as an assembly, as a devolved government, are you're swimming against the tide here, with the Conservatives, in my mind, are running this incredibly clever but despicable system whereby they're just pushing to like get people more and more sick of hearing about how the NHS is underfunded, how it's failing, how they're just pushing it to like the breaking point, almost to the point where they can go, well, the only thing we can do is privatise.
Yeah.
And I just feel that no matter what we do here, we're kind of swimming against that tide of like slowly inching towards a point where people will just throw their hands up and be like, fine, do what you want with it.
Yeah.
Like,
I think that there's enough people. This is when you talk about the United Ireland issue, it's one of the biggest issues that's there, is the fact that health here is free at the point of contact. It's not in other countries.
Mm.
And as soon as the population thinks, oh, I have to pay to go and see my GP, it's a heart.
But there's already like those sorts of charges being put in places in England.
There
and
are.
It's horrifying.
But Northern Ireland is a different system. We don't have NHS, remember, in Northern Ireland. It's Department of Health here. Mm. You know, it's run the same, but it's different. But the thing is, with Northern Ireland, we get what we get for health, and the Bamford formula comes out and tells us, you know, how much we have for health.
Mm.
We choose to put a bit more into health, you know, because it's our commitment to that. We also then have the other things about the personal independence payments, the PIPs that are coming through, so people have the choice to choose how they spend their money as opposed to others spending it for them on services. But as far as our health service is concerned, I'm not so wedded to never privatising anything. I do believe that government health should be provided, public services should be provided by government.
Mm.
But if we're looking at the best way to provide services, maybe we do need to be looking at other options. That doesn't necessarily mean a private commercial company. What about something like a social enterprise type model, where the investment is put back in, constantly put back in, so you don't have shareholders taking anything away? You know, it's ways that we need to consider things. The whole provision of, say, for instance, homes for older people has been in the news this week. The management of that is appalling, or it seems to be appalling, especially in that one home has been identified in Fermanagh, and we have the RQIA that comes in to look over that, and they found the problems and they've closed it down, which is very sad for those families having to dissipate those old people, but at least it was found out. That's a bad example of how it can be done very badly and how it's not looking after the welfare of people. But if it's
that,
not
that, that ultimately, like, two things that it has to be run efficiently, and it has to, priority number one has to be the people it's servicing.
Yeah. So if we make sure that if we do have to make cost efficiencies, what I'd be expecting is all the department, there's a bit of nonsense goes on with it. There's Department of Health, the PHA and the trusts.
Mm.
And they pass the buck between each other. I'm doing a piece of work at the moment looking at the recycling policies, because I've noticed with a lot of the local councils that when they have upped their recycling policies and improved their recycling processes, they've saved a ton of money. Like £1 million in Ards and North Down, for instance. Huge amount of money in
Oh, yeah, I just came back from a year in Canada. I was shocked at the amount of recycling done. Like, even my mum, who I've been constantly bugging to get like a compost bin, like,
so
for
something
a kitchen.
As simple as that within something like our health service. What is their strategy? They're meeting basic requirements, but there could be so much more done, and that could save money. Why do they have transport? Could they not outsource that to Translink? It could be another part of government to do it more efficiently, because there's transport planning in there. You know, the car parks that they've given to all of these private companies where the money goes back in again because of this investment that they've done. What?
Don't even start me on the car parks. I think the car parks are the most despicable things on the planet. Like, to the boys that the NHS is free at the point of service, and then to charge the nurses who are taking net, like, real world pay cuts and dealing with having to, like, just no pay increases, like a 1% pay cut that's, like, with inflation, like, their money is going less, and like just to be like turned around and be like, yeah, you have to pay to park at the free public health service is the most despicable.
But then
thing.
I would turn around and say, I have never really worked anywhere where here's the only place I've ever actually had free parking. You know, you pay for park, if you take your car to work.
But they don't have the option to take public transport, as we discussed earlier. You know,
they do.
Well, they don't have the option to take reliable public transport.
Yeah, but the thing is, yes, you could actually have it that the health transport says, you see all that money you're paying out, would you just rather have a bus put on from somewhere, we'll get you there. You know, there are other ways of doing that. But the thing is, that parking, why did they give that? The way it has been structured is...
But this is part of the sell-off of the NHS. This is what's happening. Like, you can't run a public service where profit is involved as a priority.
Yeah.
In my mind, you can't. And I agree, like, with Translink, it's a public corporation. That's the potential for some of the services. But the way it has been run... like a business where they're going for efficiency savings, it's all about ticking boxes, make X amount of money, but it ignores like the frontline service that you're trying to provide. And then
it's about the public service. That's why I believe that the public health service should not be privatized, because there will always be people who will need that service who don't have income.
Yeah.
So you'll have children, you'll have older people, you have people who are living in poverty, you have people with disabilities, you have lots of different people there who need that service. However, I look at the prescription charges, and I know that there's a cost processing prescription charges, but that is something, if somebody can afford to pay, why don't they? Because we do currently have a system where we do have people who are going in and getting paracetamol on a prescription so they don't have to pay for it, and you can buy it for 16p in Tesco.
Well, then I would very much say that why not give them a voucher for 16p paracetamol in Tesco?
But there's other ways of doing it. For instance, prescriptions don't always have to be about medication. It has started now with a few GP surgeries where they're prescribing going along to a local council gym to remove your obesity so that you can then have a fitter life and you're less prone. It's all about the prevention. The prevention stuff needs to have the investment. So what we're doing at the minute is we're spending all this money on acute services, and we're spending all this money looking at the problems of health. Well, actually, we're taking our eye off 20 years down the line. This is still going to be as bad because we're not doing the prevention stuff. The prevention stuff doesn't always sit within health. It could be within communities. It could be within better housing. It could be within better access to public transport. So you walk a bit and
education.
Then you get on the bus. Education, all of that. It needs to be a holistic thing. Health is struggling. It is bursting. It's not sustainable. But what we need is a government with parties that will understand that we need reform and to be grown up about it and say, okay, if we're going to do this reform, let's do the reform. Let's be open and honest with the public. For instance, at this moment in time, you can't go to every hospital to get a hip replacement. You go to Musgrave Park.
But that's understandable.
Hospital.
Like, would you not
but
rather
people,
have people specialise?
But people don't understand that, because if I was to turn around tomorrow and say, okay, then the Ulster Hospital's maternity ward is closed and everybody has to go to Lagan Valley. But you'll go to Musgrave Park to have...
But if people were getting if they were getting, for example, like you said, a voucher for a bus or a shuttle or a service to get them there...
Well, they do. Benefits, you do get that repayment.
But it's still like you've got to have the money to fork out to get back.
Exactly.
But
the problem
is, would people find it as big an issue if they were just getting for example, someone was getting a shuttle bus to the Ulster, or someone's getting a shuttle bus to Lagan Valley. If they were getting the shuttle bus from the same place and they didn't have to do anything different, do you really think people would be as angsty about doing it? Or do you think it's just do you think it is genuinely just like the change of place that is...
Change. It's in business, you talk about change management. Community development, you talk about change management. This is about change management. It's about explaining to people, we're not taking a service away from you. What we're doing is we're actually improving it.
Mm.
We're just putting it in a different place. So a lot of people crack up if they don't have a primary school within a certain distance from them, a GP surgery within a certain distance
those are kind of different though. Like a specialised hospital service is very different to a primary school or a GP clinic.
Is it?
Well, yes, because
anybody
everyone is going to need a primary school that for children, realistically, there's never going to be an area where there is no children living. Everyone's going
to
need a primary school within a certain area.
You don't have to have 10 in one area.
No, I agree, but to suggest that you can't, that primary schools and GP's offices are used far more frequently by everyone. Like, how many people really need a hip replacement? department within.
But people go to hospitals to you know, meet up with, say, for instance, the optologist. To be honest, you don't get to go to the Ulster. People don't actually realise this at the minute. You don't really get that many appointments in the Ulster Hospital anymore for eyes. You have to go to Lisburn. And that's just the way it is. That has been happening, but people don't realise, but we're actually closing that bit in the Ulster Hospital now, and that space is going to now be used for whatever the specialism is going to be in the Ulster Hospital. The City Hospital is the place, the specialist place for cancer.
Yeah.
We've got some stuff in Anthony Galvin because it is a bit of a distance. You know, we have specialist children's cardiac.
Because like surely that uses the resources better.
Yes, and but this is the point. It does. That's why the reform is needed. We need to do things better. But that means that we don't necessarily have to have certain hospitals where they are.
Okay.
So the Down Hospital, which is a very, very emotive subject, doesn't really have any specialisms in it. It could be like Ards Hospital, where it goes to a minor injuries unit or something, but that is very emotive and people are cracking up about that. And some of it is to do with access to the other hospitals that are going to take up the cover. Some of it's to do with the fact that there's been a hospital there and people have their children there and their families died there and lots of, you know, it's emotionally connection to people. But, you know, health needs reform, but it also needs political parties to come together and agree to take forward that reform without gutting each other in the process.
Well, I think that is a very nice note on which to leave it.
Thank you very much.
No problem. Well, thanks for coming on the show. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, and I hope you enjoyed the chat.
My first ever podcast. Thank you very much.
Not a problem. Thanks so much for watching. If you want to hear more from us, you can subscribe to us on iTunes or subscribe to our email list to get an update every time we've got a new podcast out. Later in the week, we're talking to Joe Scott from Answers with Joe, so be sure to look out for that. Until then, thanks for listening.